interview with Professor Chester Crocker at Georgetown University on July the 20th, 1998. The interviewer is Sutherland. Sir, I'd like first of all to thank you for agreeing to participate in this Yale Oral History Project on the United Nations. And I'd like to start really by asking you a question, a rather general question.
Yes, there was a lot of knowledge, and of course when you say the Reagan administration, my colleagues, we were very small, and it was clearly something which was not particularly interesting. There was some discussion, but so we decided that in fact our leverage would be enhanced by reliance. We always use the terminology on the full basis of resolution. It was a lively debate. But the fact that we were prepared to operate that way gave us the ability to 435 and to push the other side of the agenda, which was the...
When you say additions to resolution 435, you mean in terms of the operational program that was developed? In that relation.
For example, the flesh...
Those are two questions that I wanted to pursue. This question of impartiality, that was somewhat difficult, if I can say so, for the UN.
I've made the whole question that I just referred to a lively debate initially.
Back to my initial question, at this particular point, the United Nations was not especially popular among some elements of the administration and also within the Congress. Going into this from the perspective of the United Nations then, which I might say, this create problems. Did this make it for the UN spillover?
No, I think that was part of an overall distaste. I mean, if you, people used to ask me, you know, where are you feeling the heat from? It often was from the right as well as from the left. In the early months and years, finding out that, I mean, how on earth could Ronald Reagan, of all people, be associating himself with had a point, and so we were sensitive to that, but we...
You mentioned leverage, and that your leverage would be increased by staying with the... I mean, I assume that...
We wanted a fresh start, and the way we adopted what I've subsequently come to call the flypaper principle, when you have a recalcitrant party that holds the keys to movement and this negotiation as it evolved in the 80s. That group came to understand that we had an ability to maybe get a hearing in Pretoria that they didn't have, or some of them didn't have. That began to change, actually, as time passed, because Helmut Kohl and Margaret Thatcher had some credibility.
As long as this is red, there it's worth
it. Yeah, all right.
It's very important. Continuing that, I think in the period of the contact group, in their great period, the at least implied leverage was essentially economic.
I've never understood that leverage. I've never really seen it. It is South Africa's principal Congress and other people's congresses. It came much later. The key Western powers were seen as the people with the highest general credibility in Africa, in that part of Africa. Something of a balanced ticket. With
To what extent was the winding down of the Cold War, from your perspective, an important element, Angolans and the South Africans, too?
That's a question I've given a lot of thought to, and as I indicate in my book, I think that this was well underway when, by the time you could say that, in a sense, I think the sequence has to be looked at with great, it's joined a moving train in May of 1988. It was a little, it's moving because Angola had become Castro's Vietnam.
You mentioned the Cubans. I want to get a little bit out of the chronology that I had established to branch off to them for just a moment. I'd hate to miss all of the first.
Stops and then starts, it seems like. It stops and goes.
Yes, that's because it's voice activated, but now now it's not.
All right.
It's moving now, right?
Maybe it's moving now, yeah. Maybe I should speak up a little bit because it's activated, yeah.
But I put it off of voice activated now, so it's
okay.
It'll keep on going. When the Secretary General Perez de Cuellar visited Castro in Cuba and had a rather extensive 3 days of unbroken conversation with him, Castro painted a rather different picture of his position in Angola, and said that in fact it wasn't really costing them much, and if there were other places he could send as many troops with no great problem for himself. But on the other hand, he was perfectly willing to withdraw them. He had no desire to keep them there. That differs from your perception. Yours is based on intelligence reports or on what?
Well, we're talking about different years, too.
Yeah.
I think that mission took place in 83 or 84?
It was a little later than that. Mm-hmm. I think about 85, yeah.
I've forgotten the exact year, but what I'm referring to is the breakthroughs of 87 and 88.
Right.
We'd had earlier indications that the Cubans would like to bid and to be involved directly. For them, I think the key was to be an acknowledged party in this process. Mm-hmm. They weren't about to have Americans mediating between South Africans and Angolans, they would say, about issues of direct concern and interest to the Cubans, unless they were in the room. So they were pushing for a seat at the table. That's the way we interpreted it, and it turned out that in fact was important. Also, I think I would not necessarily put high credence in what Fidel Castro was saying at that point about how maybe he could do this in five other countries. If you look at it, this was equivalent at its peak to a larger burden on Cuban manpower than the American presence in Vietnam at its peak. And they were bringing home tales of woe. They were bringing home awful scenarios of corruption and involvement in illicit trafficking. They were bringing home diseases not seen since the 13th century from central Angola. And it was not a pretty picture. So he may have been beating his breast a bit there in that discussion.
Now, you mentioned the question of, or perhaps I did, of impartiality on the part of the United Nations, and the problems that arose from the General Assembly actions. You, in your book, I think, comment very favorably on the capacity of the Secretary General to maintain confidence of the South Africans as well as the other side. In Washington, or for that matter, on your part, did you always see that distinction between what one might call the United Nations in its General Assembly mode and the Secretary General?
Yes, I think that's a very important distinction. The United Nations has a series of institutions and procedures that do not always endear it, and certainly did not always endear it to American diplomats of any administration, I might say. It was a very strange entity, and it's changing, of course, today. But I mean, really, it was in many ways the mood was distinctly anti-American, and anti those things that we cared about too, for that matter, whether in the Middle East or in Africa. But leaving that aside, I mean, there were and there are some highly competent people in the UN system. There are also some fools and some inept people, as there are probably in many systems, and some corrupt people, I might add. But we found the Secretary General and two or three others to be very, very helpful as, if you will, sounding boards, as partners, as people that you felt you could take into your confidence, provided they understood that we didn't want an army of others in the room at the time, because we knew there were agents inside that building, unhelpful people who would just pass every conversation back to their favorite East German lawyers for transmission to Luanda or whatever. So we took them, those we thought were interested in getting the job done, we took them very seriously. We visited with them quite regularly. We listened to what they had to say, and I think they listened to what we had to say. They became part of a network, if you will, an informal network. I went out of my way to stay in touch with them. And I think there probably were times when people would say in Washington, why are you going to the UN again? Well, I was putting money in the bank. Quite frankly, I was putting money in the bank. I mean, I knew that this was appreciated in New York. We took Paris de Guerre seriously. Equally important, Jean Kirkpatrick took him seriously, and she was running our U.S. mission up there at the time. She thought it was worthwhile, and I think her successors did. So,
Jean Kirkpatrick did?
Yeah. Because of Paris de Guerre.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the U.N. I mean, there's no such thing as the U.N. when you stop and think about it. It's like saying, you know, there's a telephone call, it's the White House, you know. Who in the White House? Well, it's the same in the U.N.
But this is a particularly interesting point. Again, because this was all happening at the same time that other things were happening. The Falkland was over by that time. But I think it's true that Jean Kirkpatrick maintained full respect for the Secretary General at that time, too.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of Central America, there were some very severe problems that, that reached right up to the top of the White House.
Yeah.
In that connection, I just have a question here. Then Vice President Bush called the Secretary General several times in connection with Namibia, more frequently in connection with Central America, but I'm talking about Namibia now. Was he involved in your team, so to speak? Was he? Did he have a special role?
I wouldn't say he had a special role, but he was very much au courant. We briefed him regularly, and he would give us his views. And he did take a couple of trips to Africa, and he during my watch, and he did a lot of helpful effort to get our case across at the highest level, or very near the highest level. He believed in what we were doing, and I think he'd like to think he could help along here and there, so he did so. He met a lot of visiting Africans, hosted them in his home as well as in the White House. And as you say, he would reach out to people in the UN system as well, which was basically helpful to us. I think it was important for people not to have the illusion that no one above my pay grade cared about these issues. We were working as an administration on a lot of issues, as you said, and these African issues were not always front and center. So it was helpful to us. I recall times we were trying to bring parties into Washington who were very skittish about dealing with us. We'd take them right over to the Vice President's office. So that's an example.
Mm-hmm. Could you be a little bit more expansive on the value you found in keeping in pretty close contact on a confidential basis with the Secretary General throughout this rather long period?
Well, it's partly information exchange.
Mm-hmm. You did get information from the UN, from him?
From him, but also from others. I mean, I don't want to make this sound only like it was about him, because it clearly wasn't. There were a couple of world-class people circling around this issue in the UN system for some very substantial.
I think you
time.
Mentioned Omayyad for one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And another, of course, is the current president of Finland, who was an outstanding public servant, Martti Ahtisaari. So, and there were others. I mean, initially it was, I'm losing my memory here, Marty's predecessor, you know who I mean, the British chap.
Brian Urquhart,
who actually taught me a good bit of what I knew about the UN plan when I first came in. And Brian would listen to us, and then after he'd had enough of listening to us, he would tell us what he thought. Brian was very helpful, especially in the first Reagan term, I would say, after that, when he retired, when he was less in the picture.
Yeah. Then it was somebody else. And his successor, in fact, paid a visit to Angola. Just before the April 1st,
mm-hmm.
And was told by Mujomo at that point that SWAPO had bases in Namibia. which the United Nations did not believe. What was your impression on this? I mean, on his claims as far as the presence of SWAPO troops in Namibia?
Camps. Fantasy. It was the sheerest fantasy. SWAPO never liberated a square centimeter of Namibian territory. And that whole April 1 fiasco was an effort, ex post facto, to rewrite the history books, to rewrite the diplomatic history, and to use diplomacy as a means to achieve something on the ground that had never been achieved in war. So it was just a pack of lies, is what it was. And there are an awful lot of people out there prepared because of their distaste for South Africa or their political correctness or whatever to try and find some way to interpret April 1 as a basis of, on the basis of misunderstandings. Well, there was an agreement reached in 82 which covered all this. And SWAPO was in the room and was party to it with its frontline state brothers and sisters, and it was a done deal. SWAPO may have thought better of it afterwards, or have found difficulty selling it. Maybe people inside the movement were not fully informed by their UN people of what they'd agreed to. And any number of explanations are possible, but they all involve essentially violating agreements.
Right. Now, as you say, there were differing interpretations of this, which extended into the United Nations. Were you aware that there was considerable criticism within the UN Secretariat of the actions of Ahtisaari at the time of this breakthrough because of his agreement to the release of South African troops?
Well, it's totally predictable that there would be, because competent people of integrity are always going to have enemies in any system. And that you had this gaggle, this solidarity rally of people who were always taking the side of SWAPO, and some of them were in effect inside the system. Some of them were simply in the diplomatic networks. This all eventually passed, and once Ahtisaari was able to rely on the splendid diplomatic talents of Joe Lugwela to reach out to the African constituency sort of firsthand from the position of deputy, that this passed.
And you welcomed Lugwela's appointment?
Oh, Joe's superb.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely superb. Yeah, I mean, that was a good idea, although I to have it imposed on you because of people nattering behind your back in New York probably wasn't very pleasant for Marty, but Marty and Joe were quite capable of working it out.
I think that's true. Going now to the question of sanctions, in the United Nations, of course, there was constant pressure for ever-increasing sanctions against South Africa, partly because of Namibia, partly, of course, because of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
What was the effect of these campaigns? If they resulted in, at least in the earlier period, of one or two U.S. vetoes? What was the reaction, though, in Washington to this constant chorus in the UN calling for sanctions?
Well, I think it was seen pretty largely as exactly that, a chorus, an orchestrated chorus, and part of an understandable sort of historical lobby effort, part of the effort of the ANC and its network and its friends to isolate South Africa diplomatically and to keep the heat on through boycotts of all sorts, some of which had more impact, I think, on white South Africans than others. And of course, this chorus was also well subsidized by the European left and by churches of various kinds and by the Soviets and by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, to call it very specifically what it was. And you know, we saw it as a kind of a phalanx coming down the road, and we would deal with it as we thought we had to. I mean, I suppose you could say that it had a residual value as pointing out to the South Africans that they were, in fact, in the global doghouse, in case they needed reminding of that fact, you know, and that only cooperation with the Reagan administration could get them out of that doghouse. So, that, you know, it did have that backdrop quality to it. You know, there's the doghouse, okay?
And they had nothing to expect from the UN.
Right, yeah.
You could say. In your book, I think you indicate that in the final phase, you favored an even earlier date than April 1st as the date of the ceasefire and coming into effect of 435.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the date proved to be very dangerous because the UN wasn't quite prepared. Also, and that was partly because of the disputes over the cost,
mm-hmm.
in which the United States played its usual role. Did you see at the time the problem that this could cause, that is, of an ever decreasing time span?
Yeah, it was. It's hard to say what's the chicken and the egg here. I was uneasy about all the efforts at the last minute to sort of rewrite the plan. And the compromise that was come up with, you know, we'll use 4,800, but we'll have more if we need them, was a classic diplomatic finesse, I guess you could say. What did concern me was not letting the thing drag on such that the UN would not be able to deploy, and that's, of course, what ultimately happened. You can say it was the fault of the West or of certain members of the Western community for raising the issue, but since the West pays for virtually everything that the rest of the world lives off of and free rides on, I suppose the West has a right, and I will say this with emphasis for your record, to raise questions of cost. It's our taxpayers, it's our money. We don't owe it to anybody. We do it because we're citizens of the world. And I don't like being in arrears, but let's face it, we're the ones paying the freight, and others are the ones coasting. So I think we had a right to raise those questions. The delays were occasioned in part by activities in the General Assembly, as you know, as well as in the Security Council. So I don't think we covered ourselves in glory or anybody else either. The net result for Peres de Cuellar was he was stuck with this and with a date, and he didn't want to violate the date, so it was agreed to go forward. None of us could have foreseen the depth of the strategic stupidity of SWAPO's move on April 1, or for that matter, the ability to be looking the other way of the Angolan government, which could hardly have been unaware of what was being planned, or for that matter, the Cubans and the Soviets. And we called them all on it at that meeting in Mount Etcho, Namibia in April of 89, and said, where were you guys? What were you doing? And we're told, and this was fascinating, that Fidel Castro was angrier than we were, that he was throwing things at his subordinates saying, what are you doing to my peace plan?
Really?
Yeah, he was furious. He saw the whole thing going up in smoke, and he didn't want that to happen because he wanted the deal done.
Mount Etcho raises the question, which actually goes back before Mount Etcho, but the implementation of 435 and other aspects of UNIVEN eventually were really dependent on the United Nations, for better or worse. But the UN role was usually that of observer in these mm-hmm. meetings that took place.
Mm-hmm.
A Secretary General other than Peres de Cuellar might have objected to that, and I wondered what was the reason for that? Why was the UN kept off to the side, so to speak?
We're talking about the very end of the process or all the way along?
All the way along, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the UN as such doesn't exist, as I mentioned, excepting through its representatives, and it would have been very difficult, I think, for us to include the UN in bilateral conversations with the two separate sides in the period before we got to direct talks.
Right.
I wouldn't have wanted it. I would not have been confident. I'm not sure they would have wanted it, because we were dealing mostly with the issue of getting the parallel movement on the Cuban issue.
Which the UN could not acknowledge.
And the UN could not acknowledge it, or at least it appeared that way. So how would you do this? How would you have the UN involved? Very tricky. The UN, I mean, I ferried in my plane UN people to meetings. They were there. We talked to them as often as we talked to the Russians, which was often at 2 in the morning or even later. And everybody was networking with everybody. People learned a lot from, because the UN people who really counted on this issue were masters of the game. They knew the diplomacy. They knew not just the diplomacy in the abstract sense, but the personalities. They knew not just that you should call Tanzania if you want help on X, or Mozambique if you want help on Y, but who in Tanzania to call. And that kind of expertise is rare, partly because some of these folks have been in their jobs a long time, whereas diplomats in Western governments tend to turn over, you know, every 2, 3, 4 years. So they were involved, but as you say, they were not involved officially. Mount Etcho, I've forgotten which of the parties, maybe it's in somebody's memoir, asked that they be brought in, and the UN was helicoptered into the Mount Etcho meetings kind of toward the end of those discussions. But if it makes anybody feel good, we weren't involved in those discussions much either. We were there to make sure they came out right. But we and the Russians had a good time off in a corner by ourselves. So the three parties, Cuba, Angola, South Africa, were the ones who worked out the Mount Etcho understandings.
The one I had in particular in mind, besides Mount Etcho, was the meeting in Brazzaville, where I think Martin Altisari was present.
Oh, very much so. I've got a picture of him on the plane with me, so I know he was.
But at that meeting, I think the plans for UNIVAM were developed, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the end, those plans didn't work very well, and I wondered to what extent was Marty able to participate as you were developing the ideas for UNIVAM there at Brazzaville?
What respect did UNIVAM not work very well?
Well, it worked very well during the withdrawal of the Cubans, but later when its functions changed to allegedly monitoring the Angolan monitors of the encampments of UNITA and of the government. It didn't work very well at all.
But that was a completely different process, as you know. I mean,
yeah.
UNIVAM, too, had a different mandate.
Right, it did.
And that whole set of agreements was poorly handled from the get-go. Half the agreements were never implemented. They went ahead and held the election anyway. I can give you chapter and verse on that. It's really a different diplomacy. UNIVAM 1 worked well enough that the Cubans left ahead of schedule.
Right.
I think it was a modest confidence-building measure, essentially, which internationalized, for Castro's benefit, the dignity of a Cuban-approved withdrawal schedule, and internationalized, for South Africa's benefit, the parallelism of the two tracks, and then it got the job done. Just to make sure it would, we had our own national technical means watching.
You didn't fully trust the UN monitors?
We wanted to make sure we could figure out who's counting whom.
Initially, I think I believe there was a Spanish commander.
Mm-hmm.
He was not happy at first because he felt that he had not been given sufficient ability to directly monitor under the agreements that he signed.
No, there was some concern about that. You know, you're standing at the gate there with mm-hmm. counting Cubans as they get on the boat, but what about nighttime? You know,
mm-hmm.
are they coming back at night? I think there was a bit of a problem there. So the only way you could really be sure is by watching the baseball fields get grown over with grass.
As you say, going back now to this question of the SWAPO encampments before April 1st, it was your understanding on the American side that they were to be, that they were being monitored by the Angolans.
Yeah, that there was a requirement that they be monitored by the Angolans. Yeah, not the Zambians, because they'd left Zambia by then pretty much.
Yeah,
but by the Angolans, yes.
And did you have any doubts about that? That they were doing it?
Well, I mean, the proof's in the eating in something like this. We didn't want to go into it presuming bad faith. The Angolans have a very special quality of efficiency, I guess is the way I would put it. And so we had maybe some skepticism that it would work the way it might have worked had it been conducted in Holland. But they had an obligation, and they had a lot at stake, getting South Africans out of their hair.
Going now to the OAU. The OAU was extremely unhappy at times with Marty Ahtisaari, and because of that, with the actions of the United Nations in the end phase. Did the OAU cause problems for you?
No. I'd say not. There was a network within the OAU. The OAU as such, again, it's sort of like the UN. It depends. Mm-hmm. It depends who there. There were various voices inside the OAU, but the one that was the most strident would be the, you'd hear from maybe the Zimbabweans or from who were in on this one, maybe fronting for somebody else. You wouldn't necessarily hear from the Ivoirians or from the Senegalese, who were amazed at watching Africa shoot itself in the foot in this manner. But the real concern we had was with the frontline states as a group, because they were the ones on the ground in the region. The OAU didn't bring any additional troops or diplomats ready to bear. So I'd look at it as part of the chorus again, that you, the term you used earlier.
Right. And you give in your book rather full profiles of the frontline state leaders.
Mm.
I wondered if you'd expand a little bit though on Dos Santos. The impression which Perez de Cuellar had of him was that he was not a very effectual person, that he had a hard time making decisions, and when he did make decisions, he didn't necessarily carry them out. Although they had a good relationship because they could speak together in Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
Was this your... would you agree with that? How would you characterize him?
Well, he's a survivor, that's for sure. He was a compromise candidate when he came in. You know, when Neto died,
mm-hmm,
unexpectedly at the hands of Soviet medicine, Dos Santos was a young fellow, a Soviet-trained petroleum engineer, and nobody thought he had a power base. He probably didn't have much of one initially, but he throughout that long period, I'm talking now 20 years, he has moved amongst the different camps and factions, the dynasties, the clans, as they call them, within his party, and established his authority and done pretty well for himself. But there were times that I totally agree with the characterization that you mentioned, where I would just shake my head and wonder if there's any there. He just wouldn't make up his mind. Well, maybe that's partly because no decision is itself a decision. Maybe it's partly because he was unable, literally unable, to do what he would like to have done. He may have been prevented from doing what he would like to have done by hardliners, or by Cubans, or by Russians, or who knows. It was a very obscure system, and, to us, very hard to read. And there were very definitely different views within it.
To what extent did the South Africans come to you and complain about the UN? About various again, I realize I'm talking generically now, mm-hmm, but about, you know, even it's causing us problems. In fact, Picota wrote extremely, extremely critical letters to the Secretary General himself. But well, did they bring their complaints to you?
Sure they did. More in some years than in others. It would depend on whether they saw the prospect of something imminent happening that was important. It also depended on the nature of politics inside the National Party. A lot of this was domestic, and a lot of it was the Namibian wing of the National Party stirring up the South African wing of the National Party. What they were looking for was to, you know, to score some points for essentially domestic reasons. So quite often the abrupt letters that would flow into UN headquarters were part of Pukubota, the foreign minister, his effort to demonstrate at home that he was being tough on the UN, which was a whipping boy. But they would quite often bring their concerns to us, and vice versa. We also heard a lot from the UN system about rumors that the South Africans were about to do A, B, and C, and what are you going to do about it, kind of thing. You know?
Well, that brings me to the next question. What, if anything, did you try to do to control the South Africans in that period immediately following the SWAPO incursion, when there were the SWAPO were taking fairly aggressive actions to the Mali?
Oh, you're talking about 89.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you try to, as the Secretary General was trying to do, did you try to restrain them at all or not?
Well, we pointed out to them that they were right on the edge. You know, I think it's fair to say that Margaret Thatcher at that point probably had more stroke with the South Africans than we did. She was there on April 1.
She was in Windhoek, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was in Windhoek, and she made a terrific difference in the way this whole thing played out, both because she didn't want the whole thing to go down the drain, and she was very tough on that point with the South Africans. And because she, you know, also was quite clear in her commentary to the Secretary General and to Marty Ahtisaari. You know, these people have broken the agreement, therefore, and she was very direct.
She was very direct and very supportive of the release of the South African troops. But there was in the following weeks and even months, there was the problem of the so-called Kurd people who allegedly had been disbanded, but mm-hmm. who were there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have conversations, as the Secretary General did, with the South Africans about this particular problem?
Yeah, we said obey, you know, follow the agreements. We pushed them to follow the agreements and pointed out that, in fact, it would serve their interest not to be seen as the people that everybody was complaining about, but rather the party that was going along with its commitments under the plan. I have to say to you that I left public office in April 20 of 1989, so mm-hmm. a lot of the history after that I was not directly involved in. I've tracked it closely, but I wasn't in office.
I know, that's why I'm not including any questions about the actual performance of UNTAG,
yeah,
because that was after you had left.
Although, you know, on balance, it was not a bad show. Not a bad show at all. One of the best UN performances overall.
I'm going. U.S. obviously was the major player in bringing the South Africans, and I would say the Angolans also, to the agreement. But were there other pressures, in your opinion, that were effective outside the UN? I mean, global pressures that were exerted. You mentioned Margaret Thatcher, of course, but that was at the very mm-hmm. end. But as one was moving to get the Cubans out and so forth, the Soviets, I think you have said, were more or less observers at that point.
They became more open-minded to the possibility that our diplomacy could produce a win-win outcome. And so from the period roughly May of 88, and especially after July of 88, toward the very end of the negotiation in December of 88, they became less obstructive and even would help at the margins if they were given some advice as to how they might help. For example, we encouraged a direct South African Soviet conversation, and I'm sure that the South Africans found that not only titillating but useful in terms of the debates back home in Pretoria. To be able to say the Russians have told us that socialism will not be built in Namibia. That kind of confidence-building gesture was probably helpful.
That's an interesting point, and here I like your perception, which goes a little bit beyond the period of your office, while you were in office. Again, Pérez de Cuellar was really surprised at the change in Njoma. He did not have a high opinion of him when he was just the leader of SWAPO. He thought he was doctrinaire. But he turned out quite different when he returned to Namibia. What was your perception on that? You surely knew him as well as anybody else.
Oh, I doubt that. We saw him in very specialized circumstances. He appeared often to be doctrinaire and to be just sour and persuaded that we were on the other side. I don't think some of his people really ever believed that, but somebody had gotten to him. When you live in exile and, you know, you're using somebody else's apartment all the time, sometimes it may color your thinking. But this, obviously, President Njoma had figured out the way Namibia might work if he could ever get the chance to run for office. And it's worked kind of that way. It's a pretty top-down system. It's a pretty patrimonial system. And it is not a one-party state, but it is. It's a democracy, but there is a very, very strong SWAPO majoritarianism across the land. He has a problem there, which is that there isn't any opposition. So what's he supposed to do, invent it?
Well, now, in the same trend, I'd like to ask you about Savimbi. I think the American pressure for a political solution came somewhat later, but certainly the UN and the person of the Secretary General was suggesting to Dos Santos the desirability of a political solution much earlier. Was the American side pressing Savimbi at all toward any direction? I mean, what was the relationship there?
Well, we were clearly looking in a way to try and get a win-win for everybody, but one step at a time. And our view was that if we had added the internal reconciliation issue to the agenda during the mid-80s, we would have overloaded our diplomatic circuits, and we would not have been listened to by much of anybody. We did talk about it with the MPLA. They were the resistance point, not UNITA. UNITA said from the beginning, we want national reconciliation. That was always their position. What they meant by it, we can all discuss. But they wanted to be included in power. And the MPLA position was to exclude them from power as illegitimate bandits, you know, the banditas armadas kind of rhetoric that they would always throw. So we tried to push the issue of reconciliation. We particularly toward the end, we pushed it with the Russians, with the Cubans, with the Angolan government, with neighboring African countries. I spent months of my life talking to Zaire Wa and to Zimbabweans and Botswanans and Ivoirians and you name it.